Anya peered around the end of the aisle to see Kim's nephew still standing in the doorway to the back room. He was holding the gun with both hands now in an effort to steady himself. She stepped out from the aisle, dragging the unconscious Kim into view.
I'd drop the gun, unless you want to end up like your uncle.
Anya wanted to put some distance between him and the gun.
And I'd back up a bit. Nung, right? I heard Kim call you Nung.
Yes.
Be a good fellow, Nung, and put your hands behind your head.
He got to his knees for good measure. She tugged Kim behind the back counter and picked up the gun, emptying the bullets and tossing them in an urn that had been serving as someone's spittoon. She'd intended to question Kim, but he was soundly out.
Nung, I've got a few questions, and it would be in your best interest to answer them. You understand English fine, yes?
Yes.
Anya pointed at the chair she'd been tied to.
Sit and make yourself comfortable.
The phone on the desk was an old rotary model that was almost as antique as the merchandise. She used it to call the consulate, where she talked to Rose Walters. She told Anya that Pete was out of the building. After providing the antique shop's address and giving a quick recap of her activities, leaving out the sword fight, she hung up and turned her attention to her prisoner.
How old are you, Nung? How old are you?
22.
Old enough that you should know not to get mixed up in something like this. Old enough not to wave a gun around unless you really know how to use it.
I can use a gun.
Oh, you can pull the trigger, you just can't aim. The police aren't coming, are they?
No.
Who is?
Men who work for my uncle. The alarm summons them.
How many?
I do not know. I just know that if trouble comes, the men come. They should be here soon.
Nung, I want to be gone before those men you mentioned arrive. Understand?
Yes.
So you're going to talk quickly. Then I'll be away and you can go about your business. I don't want to hurt you. But if I have to...
What do you want to know?
Who is behind all of this?
I don't know.
Anya stepped to the desk, sticking her passport and wallet back in her fanny pack and strapping it on. She picked the crumpled business cards off the floor and flattened them as best she could, then stuffed them back in her pocket. She took her camera, too, which they seemed to have repaired, or at least jury-rigged to view the pictures.
Try again. Who is behind this?
Lan Vuong.
Pardon? I couldn't hear you.
Lan Vuong!
Is that the Sandman? I heard your uncle talk to someone named the Sandman.
No.
So who is Lan Vuong?
An old and powerful man. An important one where I come from.
Tell me more. Where is Lan Vuong?
Hue.
Vietnam?
Hue, Vietnam.
Anya didn't need to pull the card out of her pocket. She remembered that one of the business cards was for an antique store in Hue. The desk had maps stacked on the corner. She turned her back on Nang, searching through the maps and finding one produced by National Geographic in 1967 that showed Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, and part of Burma.
You're Vietnamese, right, Nang?
Yes.
Then I've got a new idea.
Grabbing a selection of maps and the only set of keys she saw on the desk, Anya slung her backpack over her shoulders, returned to Nang, and tugged him up by his collar.
You're coming with me.
To Hue? Going to Hue?
Yes. To Hue.
She nudged him out the back door and toward the muddy jeep, just as a silver Hilux Vigo pulled into the far side of the alley. A four-door pickup, it was pristine enough to have just been driven off the showroom floor. Its windows were tinted, but Anya could make out three shapes inside.
Lovely. I'll bet those are the men who work for your uncle.
She shoved him into the jeep's passenger side, jumped behind the wheel, sitting on the maps she'd grabbed, and prayed one of the keys fit in the ignition. Anya didn't want another fight right now. She fumbled with the keys as two of the men leaped out of the Hilux, the driver staying behind the wheel.
Come on. Come on.
One man headed to the shop's back door. The other came barreling at the jeep, pulling a gun out of his waistband.
The seatbelt. Put it on, now.
Nang groped for the belt as Anya slammed her foot on the gas pedal. The right front fender clipped a garbage can and sent it and its smelly contents flying.
Duck!
At the end of the alley, she jerked the wheel hard right and swerved to avoid a parked car. Traffic wasn't heavy in this part of the city, and she took advantage of a near-empty street as she raced south. A few more turns, a cut through an alley, the silver truck gaining on her, and she found herself going west on Si Don Chai Road. A steady stream of cars headed in both directions, and exhaust filled the air and settled heavily on her tongue. She slammed her hand against the steering wheel in frustration as she weaved around a late-model Honda Civic and found herself smack behind a tour bus.
Come on!
A glance in the rearview mirror showed the pickup truck bullying the Civic onto the sidewalk.
They will kill us!
I will do my best to not let that happen!
Anya spun the wheel to the right, cutting across the opposite lane of traffic and nearly being sideswiped by a minivan.
The police!
The truck swerved right behind her. Only two shapes were visible inside, one leaning out the passenger window, the man who'd shot at them in the alley. Everything was happening too fast for Anya to get a good look at him, but his yellow shirt and his shaved head stood out. Her heart pounded. She realized he was aiming at the jerry cans in the back. He could blow them up with a well-placed shot.
Hold on!
She reached a stretch where traffic was thinner and floored it. The rearview mirror was filled with the grill of the pickup. It conveniently had no license plate.
They will kill us! They will!
Shut up!
The truck veered to the left, coming alongside the Jeep. Anya kept one hand on the wheel and extended the other. She was finding it difficult to grip the pommel with the blade meeting resistance from the wind and the speed. The truck smashed into the Jeep's side, and Anya had to compensate to keep from being pushed off the road.
Bridge!
Anya divided her attention between the road, the threatening pickup, oncoming traffic, and now the bridge, which narrowed the road to a single lane.
Come on, come on, come on!
She inched ahead of the truck. At least the passenger was inside the truck now, holding his injured arm. The driver was another matter. She spotted a gun in his hand. But he had to jump in behind her in the face of now one-lane traffic.
We will die! We will die!
Everyone dies, but I won't let us die today.
The Jeep rode up on the sidewalk as she jockeyed for a better position to see the truck behind her. The passenger was on a cell phone. She couldn't make out more than that because of the tinted windows. The driver had his arm out the window, gun against the door. At least four police cars were coming. Anya took an off-ramp at full speed, tilting the Jeep up on its right wheels and nearly tossing Nang from his seat, despite the seatbelt. She raced past a motorcycle that spun out in her wake and watched in horror as the silver truck headed straight for it.
God, please don't.
The truck driver veered to the right to avoid the motorcyclist. Anya jabbed the gas pedal again and switched lanes, driving straight west again and leaving Chiang Mai and the increasing number of sirens behind. Nang was still shaking from the wild ride in the city. She'd pulled onto a narrow road that cut through farmland. She wanted to avoid any major routes for a while, as plenty of witnesses would have described her and the Jeep to police.
Nang, I want you to tell me all about Lang Wong. You were going to do that, remember, before we were rudely interrupted by your uncle's thugs? Tell me about him.
I called him Uncle Lan when I was a boy, but he was not a true uncle.
Anya stopped and unhooked her seatbelt and raised up, pulling the maps out from under her. If she hadn't sat on them, they would have blown out of the Jeep. Stretching forward, she knocked the glass out of the window frame, making it easier to see. She began to drive again.
Go on.
Lan Vuong is an important exporter of goods from Vietnam.
Smuggler. How did he get in the business, Nang?
Because of the Vietnam War, I think. Before I was born, before my father and Uncle Kim were born, Uncle Lan was a soldier in the North Vietnamese Army. An important one, a colonel. He was in his 40s then, and he led many men to battle. Uncle Lan was captured by American fighting men in the war. Some of his men were captured also, and all of them were put in prison in South Vietnam. A bad prison, Uncle Kim told me, for 40 years.
40 years?
The papers were lost, and the prison changed hands. Uncle Kim said Lan was supposed to be free after the war, but the lost papers kept him in prison until the prison closed and everyone inside was freed.
A forgotten man.
A bitter man, with no love left for his country. Vietnam was bad to my Uncle Lan.
So he took from it. In the past few years of his freedom, he has taken relics.
What is wrong with that? Uncle Lan was owed for all the years in prison. A lifetime he spent in a cell.
Uncle Lan is a thief and a smuggler.
There were places, Uncle Kim said, where ancient golden treasures were hidden during the war. Monks did not want the temple riches to fall into American hands, so they hid them in the jungle. Uncle Lan knew of the places, and much of it was still there when he got out of prison. So, Uncle Lan and a few of the soldiers who served under him regained the treasures and sold them to wealthy men in other countries. Getting them out of Vietnam was the dangerous part, he once told me. But he had ways, and people looked the other way when he gave them gold. He sent the gold to Laos and Thailand, to hidden places in the mountains. Then buyers were found and the treasures moved on. And when those treasures were gone, he found more. He took things from temples, also from a museum once, he told me, and from burial places. Uncle Kim said the dead did not need their gold. Lan needed the gold, though. Gold and diamonds and emeralds. Uncle Lan said he would be dead soon enough because he was so old and that he would enjoy the gold while he still lived. It became, I think, the only thing he loved. Gold and money. Everything else he hated.
You don't need to be involved with all of this, Nang. The world is full of opportunities and...
This is what my family does. This is all I know. But I do not hate like my Uncle Lan does. I do not hate everything. You, though, I hate you.
Anya sat the map of northern Vietnam on Nang's lap.
Read this map to me. Read about Hue. Tell me all about Hue.
It is 700 kilometers from Chiang Mai to Hue.
Good to know. Tell me more.
Hue has a population of 350,000, a little more. It covers 5,000 square kilometers. It has many districts. Fengdian, Quangdian...
Anya let his voice trail to the back of her mind. She knew the dirt road they drove down was not on her map, but that she'd eventually come to something larger that would be. The grass that lined the edges was tall and broad, and a brilliant green that gave way to paler green trees in the distance, with wide sweeping fronds. It was more of the primitive beauty that she'd noted around the teens' village, but the village she approached looked much poorer. The homes were made of severely weathered planks that looked as if a strong wind would take them down. Several of them were two levels high, with rickety-looking outer stairs leading to the second floor. The villagers wore colorful shorts and shirts that had seen better days.
This part of the country is poor.
The road narrowed, and men and women worked rice fields on both sides. There were puddles and deep ruts, and the jeep bounced with the passing miles. Far to the south were forested mountains wreathed in gray clouds. One formation looked like the humps on a camel's back.
Nang, tell me more about Hue.
Uncle Kim would take me to the palaces on the bank of the Perfume River when I was a child. Emperors and mandarins had them built. More than 100 very old buildings along that river. Tombs of the Nguyen kings there also. Lan took from some of those tombs. My favorite was the Cai Din tomb, but the Gia Long and the Min Mang I also remember. Good food in Hue. Mostly vegetables, though. Beautiful pagodas. Tourists like the pagodas. He took me to Da Nang also, my Uncle Kim. It is north of Hue and not as rainy. Hue is a very rained-on city.
Hue looks like it sits on the border between North and South Vietnam.
The Battle of Hue was in 1968, the year my older brother was born. The city was hurt very bad by American bombs. Only in recent times are some of the buildings being restored, but some will never be fixed.
Anya came to a wider road and took it, snaking around a rice field and passing an impressive-looking temple. It was hot, even after the sunset.
You are not going to let me go, are you? You are going to kill me and leave my flesh to rot.
Anya stayed silent. Let him remain in fear of her to keep him cooperative. To avoid a checkpoint along the road, Anya cut across a field, nearly miring the jeep in mud. Her passport might have sufficed to get her across the border without too many questions, but she couldn't risk Nang causing problems. They stopped at a gas station a few miles over the Vietnam border. It was a small town, and the station had been ready to close. The owner accepted her Thailand baht, but charged her extra because he would lose some money in converting it to dong. She'd needed Nang to translate for her. She loaded up on candy bars and chips, which was all the food they sold, and ushered Nang back into the Jeep, watching him while she filled the tank. If her calculations were correct, she wouldn't have to stop for gas again until they were headed back out of the country. Correction, she thought, until she was headed back. She'd leave Nang in Hue, and hope against hope that he would find a different calling than smuggling. Maybe he would have to if she could catch Lan Vuong and return him to prison.
Are you married, Nang?
No.
Is there someone you...
No.
She wondered how Lu was doing, and if he'd been able to return to the treasure cave with the authorities. She wished she could have called him from the antique store to tell him what was going on and where she was going. Maybe if there was a consulate in Hue, she would stop and try to reach him. When Nang fell asleep, she coasted to the side of the road and extricated the map from his hands. She found a small flashlight in the glove box and used it to check her route. Anya was proficient at reading maps, but the inset map for Hue was tiny and listed only major roads. She would wake Nang when they reached the city. Hue sat in central Vietnam, perched on the bank of the Huang River and a dozen miles inland from the port of Bien Dong. She guessed it was a little more than 400 miles south of Hanoi, which she knew would have a consulate or embassy. Anya nudged Nang awake.
Nang, tell me more about this city. What is that?
She pointed to an ornate building at the edge of the city, the top of which rose higher than all the buildings around it. Through gaps in the other buildings, she saw that the massive one was walled.
That one is called the Citadel. Once there was an entire city inside it. A forbidden place where only emperors and their concubines and guards were permitted. The punishment for trespassing was death. It is a tourist attraction now. You are going to kill me, are you not?
And what is that building?
The Tien Mo Pagoda, the largest one in Hue. It is the symbol of the city. Some of the royal tombs are behind it. The tombs were built while the rulers still lived. Some look like miniature palaces.
Several blocks later, he pointed out a series of old French-style buildings, Mandarin houses, and the Hue Museum of Royal Fine Arts. Anya spotted several businesses that were still open, despite the late hour. Some had signs in English and French for the tourists. One advertised all-night foot massages.
How far are we from the antique store, Nang? Tell me the best way to get there.
It was in an old part of the city. The buildings looked beat up, and half the ones on the block were closed and boarded up. There was a tavern on the corner, the only business open along the street, with a winking light that advertised Biahoy beer. Anya circled the block, seeing the antique store in the middle, and found an alley to pull into.
You will kill me now?
Does your Uncle Lan speak English?
And French. He learned in prison.
Does he live nearby?
Nang looked up. There was a low light in one of the windows.
He owns the building, the block. He lives up there, above the store.
Get out. Go on, get out.
Nang slid out, stumbling in his nervousness.
Go home, Nang. Go somewhere. I'm not gonna kill you. I'm not gonna hurt you. Just...
Anya didn't have to say anything else. He took off running, turning the corner past the alley.
I hope I don't regret that.
She could make out next to nothing in the alley. The light coming from the far end was faint, like the first hint of dawn. There were backs of buildings and staircases leading to second floors, and plenty of insects that she couldn't see but could hear and feel all around her. Not a single light burned in any windows in the back. There were stairs directly behind the antique shop, sturdy and narrow and incongruous to the rickety appearance of the front of the building. As she climbed, she touched the sword with her thoughts. The steps were not steep. In fact, they were lower than usual, perhaps made to accommodate an old man's failing legs. At the top, the The door looked sturdy and resisted her attempts to force it open. Finally, she summoned the sword and carefully used the blade to worry at the hinges until she could get it open. Unless he was deaf, he had to have heard her. She noticed as she passed through the door frame that she'd tripped a silent alarm.
Wonderful.
It would either be keyed to a police station or private security firm, or perhaps, like the antique store in Chiang Mai, to thugs who would come roaring up with guns ready. The kitchen was dark, but she could pick through the shadows enough to make her way toward the doorway. The kitchen smelled of dirty dishes and food that had been left out. She wrinkled her nose and picked up the scent of something far worse. Insects were thick inside the apartment, too.
No.
She entered a hall and felt around for a light switch, turning it on and holding the sword out in front of her. He was lying on the couch as if he'd fallen asleep, a newspaper flat against his chest and flies buzzing around his face. He'd been dead for at least a few days. She saw a chair near the couch and dropped into it. Lan Vuong had been a small man who looked ancient. The wrinkles were deep, and the skin thin like parchment, the hands twisted with arthritis to the point they looked like the claws of a bird, claws that were thick with gold rings. Three thick gold chains hung around his bloated neck. She looked away from the corpse. Anya felt sick to her stomach and cheated of answers. She'd driven through three countries to confront him and to demand answers about the Skull Bowl and the smuggling operation. She'd dragged a frightened henchman with her, who might at this very moment be calling in thugs. Lan Vuong's death had robbed her of any feeling of completion.
No, 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 no.
Anya sat there for several minutes, then pushed herself up and looked around for a phone, still cupping her hand over her nose. Anya got a good look at the furniture. Beautiful antiques, every piece, many hinting at a French origin, and most of it well-maintained. The carpet was threadbare in places, however, partially covered up by an expensive-looking Turkish rug that dominated the center of the living room. The apartment was small, the living room, kitchen, single bedroom, and a bath, all compact. There was another room, this with a stackable washer-dryer and a desk. The message light on the telephone blinked red. Anya sat at the desk, the smells of laundry soap helping to cut the odor of the old man's corpse. She remembered the phone number of the consulate in Chiang Mai. Lan Vuong would not mind if she added to his phone bill. She wanted to call the lodge, too, and see if someone there would get Luar Taro for her. But it was late, too late for an indulgence like that. After being transferred from person to sleepy person, Anya was connected to Pete Schwartz.
I'm surprised you're still working. Oh, it's because of me, isn't it? Sorry. Really, I am sorry.
She quickly related the story of her mad dash to Vietnam, leaving out her borrowing of Nang.
I wasn't sure who to call about all of this, and I didn't want to call the police just yet, Pete.
Pete told her there was a U.S. Consulate General in Ho Chi Minh City and an embassy in Hanoi, both too far away to be convenient, though he gave her phone numbers for some men he knew there and told her to call them immediately.
After everything you've put us through, I hope the hell you're planning on coming back here.
Yes, I'm coming back to Chiang Mai. I'll be leaving soon. Hey, you don't need to yell at me.
Listen to me, Miss Creed. Leave that shop right now and let the local authority sort things out, not a vacationing American archaeologist with a nose for trouble looking to get herself tossed in a foreign jail.
Yes, I'm coming right back. Right away, you can stop yelling. I'm heading back now.
Well, soon, she thought. A trip downstairs first. She considered calling the lodge to find Luar Taro, again dismissing the notion because of the late hour. She considered calling the consulate or the embassy, too, as Pete had suggested, as well as Doug Morrell to see if a crew was on its way to Thailand to film the teak coffins. Instead, she pushed the button to listen to Lan Vuong's messages. She figured she might learn just how many days ago he died based on the age of the messages. It was an old-style answering machine with a cassette tape in it. She didn't think they made those anymore. The tape was full. There were 19 messages. The first was 5 days ago, so he'd not been dead longer than that. Most of them were in Vietnamese, and she could pick out only a few words, not enough to yield anything useful. But there were 4 messages in English, all from the same man. Sandman, he called himself.
I'm worried about you, old man. You haven't returned a single call. I wanted to tell you this face to face, but you're obviously not around. Something's rotten inside. Old man, pick up the phone. Are you there?
The last was from the previous day.
Now, once again, I'm worried about you. I'll have someone stop by to check up on you tomorrow.
That would be later that day. It was after midnight. Anya paced in the tight confines of the room. She should leave, after a quick look downstairs, hop in the jeep and return to Chiang Mai to tie up any loose ends with the authorities and the consulate. She shouldn't cool her heels in a dead man's apartment waiting for someone called the Sandman. She left the apartment, turning off the lights as she went, stopping to look in the refrigerator and taking out a block of cheese and a bottle of ginger ale. The rest of the items looked either fuzzy with mold or unidentifiable. She took the back staircase down, eating the cheese as she went. It was sharp cheddar, and it helped to cut the smell of Lan's corpse. She retrieved a small flashlight from the jeep. The back door to the antiques shop required a little work to open, and she managed to bypass the alarm. It was an older security device that anyone with a little thought could dismantle. She closed the door behind her and flicked on the flashlight. A shiver coursed through her. At the top of a hutch-style desk across a crowded and cramped back room sat a skull bowl. The bowl was stoppered, and Anya held the base of the flashlight in her mouth as she worried away at the waxy seal. There were no voices in her head this time, just a desire to see what was inside. 4 more dog tags were stuck in an inch of dried blood. She pried the tags out and stuck them in her pocket and left the bowl sitting on the desk. It would be leaving with her, along with any others she found. She squeezed past a bank of file cabinets. There was no computer out in the open in the office or in the first 3 large drawers she opened, so she suspected the old man kept all of his records on paper. He'd been from another era, after all. She stepped back and opened one of the file cabinets. The drawer had only a few folders in it. Riffling through some of the pages, she saw the writing was all in Vietnamese, worthless to her at the moment.
So much for hauling away any evidence.
Still, she pulled out one file and placed it next to the skull bowl. She'd have someone translate it later. Then, Anya entered the shop. It was similar to the setup of the shop in Chiang Mai. There was a comfortable sameness to all old buildings, a showroom and a back office with a restroom tucked to the side for the employees and patrons. The odors were intense. She was far enough below the apartment that she no longer smelled lawn, but she picked up the strong scent of old things. Wood and clay, cloth, relics threatened by mildew and the years in general. Anya relished these kinds of smells and wanted to turn on the ceiling lights so she could get a better look. The beam of the flashlight was terribly inadequate. There were packing crates at the back and mounds of packing materials. They extended farther than she could see, and she realized that the antique shop was much bigger than the outside storefront implied. It extended into the other boarded-up businesses and was virtually a warehouse of antiquities ready to be packed up and moved out to buyers in other countries. The shelves were unfinished plywood, but they were massive and braced to support the weight of the objects spaced out across them. Busts, urns, statues, and more stretched farther than the flashlight beam. Anya could not help herself. She had to take a closer look at some of the works. One shelf was filled with what, to her practiced archaeological eye, looked to be artifacts from the Champa culture in Binh Dinh's coastal central province, hundreds upon hundreds of years old. They included ancient bowls, cups, and vases made of fire-hardened clay. They were museum pieces, especially the soccer ball-sized containers covered with reliefs of a sea monster called a Makara and a mythological Naga. Another shelf was filled with a collection of jewelry pieces from the Holy Land of Khat Tien, including figurines of deities made from terracotta, silver, gold, and bronze. There were stone tools that were clearly prehistoric. Anya would have liked to take them back for study to determine what region they came from and just how old they were. It wouldn't hurt to take one small piece, she told herself. She reached for a stone axe and stopped herself. She was upset that Luartaro had taken jewelry and who knew what else from the treasure cave. She had no right to take anything. She edged toward a gap in the aisle where some large objects took up a considerable section of floor. An ancient cart with intact wheels captivated her. Nearby was a large bronze drum she guessed was at least 2,000 years old. These large objects were priceless archaeological treasures that Anya knew should be displayed in a major museum. It was a crime against the world to smuggle these things. Anya recalled reading an article several months earlier about two Chinese men arrested in Vietnam with a truck full of antiquities they were taking across the border. She wondered if they'd been part of this operation. The artifacts had been Vietnamese. A bronze drum, dozens of earrings, statues, and ceramic jars. She rubbed her forehead, smearing dirt and the gnats that had stuck there. She was feeling so many things at the same time. Anger that people would steal from history and deprive the public of an opportunity to see these relics, and deny archaeologists the opportunity to study them. Elation that she'd uncovered what obviously had been a massive smuggling operation. Fear that some of the parties involved were still out there and could resume the nefarious practice. Worry that the authorities might not properly handle all these priceless things. The tavern was too distant, and the walls and shelves of this place kept its music and laughter at bay. There was no traffic on the street at this hour in this part of the city. Anya wouldn't be returning to Chiang Mai right away, as she'd told Pete. She would stay in Hue a day or two, call the American consulate and embassy, contact Doug and beg him to send a second film crew here, and call the various experts she knew in the field of ancient Vietnamese relics. She wouldn't be able to see everything through, but she could put things in motion, and that would give her a better sense of accomplishment and closure. She'd done nothing illegal, save drive a jeep from Chiang Mai that didn't belong to her, and temporarily force Nang to accompany her. She would talk her way out of trouble. She was good at that. Anya glided down the next aisle, seeing bronze jewelry dully gleam in her flashlight beam. She wanted pictures. She reached to her fanny pack. Someone had arrived out back. The pictures would have to wait. She hurried to the back of the shop, leaving her flashlight on a shelf. She'd meet them outside, refusing to risk even one relic in the fight that was to come. And Anya knew there would be a fight. It wasn't the police she'd slipped through the office to meet. Either Nang had summoned Lan's thugs, or the alarm she'd tripped upstairs had called them. She stepped out the back door and clung to the shadows up against the wall. Two men got out of a dark SUV, and a van pulled up behind it, turning off its headlights and disgorging four more men. Neither driver door had opened, so there were at least two more people that she couldn't see. The only light in the alley filtered down from a lamppost at the far end. It was nearly as dark as a cave. She couldn't make out any details regarding the men, though her instincts told her they were well armed. They looked like moving splotches of black against the gray of the walls and the vehicles, shadows upon shadows. She stared at the man heading to the door she'd just exited. All she could tell was that he was bigger than her. The man behind him started up the steps to Lan's dwelling. Common sense told her she should creep along the wall and get out of there. The odds were too great and the visibility too poor. Alive and away, she could report what she'd seen and retell what had happened in the past few days. But common sense was rarely Anya's friend, and so she angled the blade so the flat of it was out, pivoting slightly. That alerted the closest man. He stopped and stared at the wall, and she wondered if his vision was more acute than hers, and he could actually see her. But then the moment passed, and he reached for the doorknob. Anya drove the flat of the blade against his neck. He collapsed on the stoop, dropping something metallic. The man who'd started up the stairs retreated.
Look out!
Sandman. The van's lights snapped back on, catching Anya in a mid-leap kick at the man who'd just come off the stairs. The heel of her right foot landed solidly and sent him forward into another of his fellows. Momentarily blinded, Anya closed her eyes and kicked out. She opened her eyes to see two men pointing guns at her. She dropped to a crouch as bullets whizzed above her head. Then she somersaulted forward and rose right in front of the man. The sword cut through the jacket of the man on her right and into his rib cage. Anya drove the pommel up into the chin of the next man, cracking his jaw. A slug slammed into her left arm. Anya bit down hard on her lower lip, feeling a surge of adrenaline. The man whose jaw she'd broken swung his gun on her. She felt a bullet graze her right arm. She skewered him. Anya jumped to her feet and ran to the front of the van, darting around it just as someone hugging the shadows by the SUV opened fire. It was madness thinking she could fight all these men. Madness that anyone would smuggle artifacts precious to all of humanity. Madness that Zakarat died.
Madness!
Anya charged a man coming around the other side of the van. She ran him through.
Madness!
She tugged the sword out of his gut. Anya was spattered with blood, and the wound in her left arm continued to feel like fire, her right arm stinging where she'd been grazed. She slouched forward, holding her left arm in close to her body, the fire of it fading and turning to numbness. She turned and staggered toward the SUV. A man climbed out, taller than the others, thinner, and with hair so pale it looked like mist. In the light from the SUV's dome, she saw that he wasn't Vietnamese.
Sandman.
And you are a mad woman.
Hands out to your sides.
Anya raised the sword for emphasis, and he complied. She listened for any movement, either from the few men she'd knocked out rather than killed, or from the vehicles.
You are impressive. An army unto yourself. I should not have dismissed Nang's rambling so easily. He called you a pretty demon. I should have brought twice as many men.
Who are you?
Sandman, as you know. That's the name I've used in, well, quite a long time.
Tell me about this. About all of this.
She pointed the sword behind her to the back of the antique store. She had plenty of other questions, but she'd start there. He gave a great shrug of his shoulders, and she realized that beneath the long coat he wore, he was frail and rail thin.
What about it?
The smuggling, the cave in northern Thailand, all the guns, Vietnam, and all of this.
Did you kill Lon?
No, but he is dead. I don't think anyone killed him.
He hadn't been well. It was only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time for all of us, actually.
Tell me about all of this.
Well, that could take a bit.
I'm not going anywhere, and neither are you.
Yeah, apparently not. I suppose all of this started shortly after the Vietnam War. A police action, they called it. I'm sure the war was long over before you were born. I survived the war, and I didn't go home. The gold was too tempting, you see. And I found things in Vietnam to my liking. I'd been a soldier with a rifle company that had come across a stash of relics on a tour during 1966. A collection of golden Buddhas had been hidden by monks who feared that Americans would overrun their temple and take the holy objects. I took what I could carry with me and deserted, finding a few other soldiers who'd also fled their units, living from village to village, learning the language and customs. It was a small operation at first. We'd carry a few bits of holy treasure into China and make a tidy profit, reinvest it. Eventually, we set up a corporation of sorts in Saigon. We spread enough money around to get some police to look the other way. appeared to support the communist government, stuck to the shadows, never sent too much across the border at any one time. Oh, times have changed. The government's cracking down on smuggling. It seems some people want to keep the relics here, but we never sent too much at any one time. Tried not to be noticed.
It looked like a significant haul stashed in the mountains. I'd say that was too much. And I noticed.
Things have been complicated recently. More Western influence, more people concerned about the national relics and history, more guards watching the borders. If they only knew how much is gone, scattered across the globe. Most of it's gone, when you think about it. Beyond the considerable inventory in that warehouse and the pittance in a few antique stores. Yes, Lon and I saw to it that there's really not all that much left. Pity, I suppose. But it couldn't be helped. It was the best way to earn a fortune that I could think of.
How'd you get involved with him, Lan Vuong?
During the war, actually. That was the first time I met him. We ran afoul of a dink base he was in charge of, and he had the audacity to capture us. I expected to spend the rest of the war in some slimy slopehead prison, but I made friends with some of them. I'd learned enough of the language at that point to get by. I bargained my freedom with Lon for the location of a temple stash. He always did like gold. The short version is that Lon released me and two of my friends. There were four others, but he wanted some souls to take back with him. As we were running away, his camp was taken by American Marines. Now, we managed to avoid the Marines, not wanting to end up in some U.S. prison for desertion. Neither did we want to end up dead. There were a lot of bullets flying that day. I learned later that Lon had been grabbed by the Marines and tossed into a cell in the south. Many, many years he was stuck there. Later, our paths crossed again. It was an accident, really, our meeting again. Lon had found my smuggling network, and he had far more contacts than I did. He was running a few operations of his own from behind bars. When he finally got back up north, we combined our resources. Became friends, I suppose. Or as close to friends as our kind can be.
Anya stepped close and grabbed his throat. Feeling a few gold chains hanging there and dangling down beneath his shirt. There was another chain with a familiar feel to it, and this she yanked free. She glanced at the dog tag in her fingers.
And you come clean to me. Why? Why spill your guts about this?
Why? Because you asked. Because you won this war. And because I'll be joining Lon soon. Something's rotten inside. Something horribly rotten. Cancer of the pancreas, the doctor told me. He gives me a month at the most. Hurts like hell. War is old men dying in the fullness of their promise while there is still madness in this world. War is hell.
Which is where you'll end up.
Anya swung him around and pushed him toward the back of the shop. He was easy to push, frail and weak, and his hands were twisted from arthritis.
Go in!
She intended to make sure he spent whatever days he had left rotting in a cell somewhere. Anya flipped on the lights, wanting to better see the inside.
Records?
I never bothered with them. Lon neither. Not records on our real dealings, anyway.
Anya pointed to the skull bowl she'd left on the desk.
What do you know about that?
Oh, the skulls. Only that Lon liked them. Said he put souvenirs from the war in them. Said he picked them up in the States before the war. He must have had a dozen of them. Talked to them like they were childhood imaginary friends. Rubbed them like a genie's lamp and called them Papa Gede.
Anya nudged him up one aisle and down the next. She found eight more skull bowls among the treasures on the shelves, all filled with dried blood and dog tags. She forced him to carry some of them to the back room. Free, she thought, when she broke all of the seals. There were eight bowls, plus the one on the desk. Nine altogether. And the one from the mountain made 10. Two were unaccounted for, if indeed he'd had a dozen. All of them were filled with dog tags. She looked at the Sandman's dog tag. Sandusky, Merle M., Catholic.
Pretty demon. What did you do with that sword you were waving around?
Anya shoved him into a chair.
That sword looked old. I could probably find a buyer who'd give you a sweet dollar for it, pretty demon. Set it up for you if you let me walk out the door. I've only got a few weeks anyway. I'll be dead before any trial. No need to put me through that, huh? So, about that sword.
She clocked him on the side of the head to knock him out and reached for the phone, calling the Chiang Mai consulate again because in her fuzziness, it was the only number she could remember. Anya woke up 2 days later in a hospital bed in the heart of Hue, Pete from the consulate at her side. The room was simple, but at least it was private. The bed was small, and there was no television, radio, or phone. Anya scowled at the IV drip in her bandaged arm. She would find out later just who brought her in and who called the authorities. Probably Pete for the latter. He had 3 American suits with him.
From the Ho Chi Minh consulate. Some of the fellows I asked you to call. You lost a lot of blood and picked up a nasty infection. The nurse said you were covered with mud and blood when they brought you in.
There were some unusual bowls in the antique store, made of skulls and...
I don't know anything about the antiquity store other than that you were found in it, along with a collection of U.S. servicemen's dog tags that were turned over to the Ho Chi Minh consulate. Found more dog tags in a carry bag in a jeep.
There was a man with me in the antique store.
That would be Mr. Merle Sandusky. I do know about him. He's on the floor below you.
He's a...
crook. And a deserter from the military from a long time back.
A smuggler.
I gathered that. There's a guard outside his door, and they say he's going to prison. Probably for the rest of his life.
How about me? Am I going...
to prison? I have no doubt that you should. Or something. Quite a few bodies you leave in your wake. Are you sure you're only an archaeologist? But they're calling you a hero, stopping the biggest relic ring in all of Vietnam. Apparently they've been after Sandusky for years. He was a slippery fellow. So, no, you're not going to jail.
Pete reached into a big briefcase he'd sat on the floor and pulled out a laptop and a cell phone and put them on her bedside table.
Thank you.
There are some news reporters downstairs and a couple of TV crews. The doctors are keeping them at bay, but they'll eventually get up here. Reporters always do.
There are some people I want to talk to, but I'd rather avoid the news.
That isn't going to happen.
Will this laptop...
They have Wi-Fi here. Yeah, it'll work. The phone is prepaid, so take care with your calls, because when that one is empty, you're on your own.
Anya smiled. She was always on her own. She had to admit that she felt much better than she had in days. A glance under the covers revealed that her leg had been rebandaged, and her left arm was in a loose sling.
We'll leave you be for a while, but we'll be back after dinner. Some reports to fill out, plenty of questions to ask, that sort of thing.
Pete tipped his head and spun around in military fashion, walking out of the room with the other men nodding politely to her and following. Anya punched in the number for the lodge and asked the man at the front desk if he would please find Luar Taro.
He checked out, Miss Creed, early yesterday. He and his film crew packed up and took the bus to the city and the airport. But he left a note for you.
As the desk clerk, at Anya's request, read the note back to her, she could practically hear Luar Taro's gentle voice mouthing the words.
Dear Anya, what a remarkable, memorable, hell of a vacation this has been. I must get back, however. The next class session is starting soon, and I've got to prepare for it. We have to package and sell the film from the Spirit Caves. I have offers from a few networks already. I hope you don't mind, dear heart, but when you went off to Chiang Mai without me, I contacted a local film crew and had a go at the story myself. Some of the water receded, and we got some excellent shots of those bodies in the teak coffins. We made history. I'm sure if you and your crew ever show up, you can concoct a monster for your program. I would like to see you again, sweet Anya. In your country or in mine. Please stay in touch. Love, Lou.
Anya hung up the phone and flopped her head back on the pillow. She couldn't blame him, not really. The previously undiscovered teak coffins with the human remains were the real treasure of the spirit caves. She'd wanted them for a Chasing History's Monsters special, but she was fine with Loire Tarot getting the credit. Anya had more than enough hours in the spotlight, and apparently would be getting more if the television crews downstairs had their way. She was still bothered that Loire Tarot took the ancient jewelry from the cave, and she would stay in touch with him, if only to discuss that and come to some resolution. And there was the matter of the skull bowl in a museum in Florida. She'd traveled there to make sure it didn't have a seal and dog tags. A nurse opened the door a crack.
I speak English.
Yes?
You have a visitor, Miss Creed.
No, I need my rest.
Oh, I understand. He is a Frenchman. Said he came a long way, but he can wait. I will tell him to come back.
Wait. You can send Rue in.
Anya had a lot to tell him. Epilogue. Vietnam, July 1966.
Wallum! Company! More, get out here! We got...
Sandusky risked a glance outside in time to see mud spitting up around the feet of his sergeant, Gary Thompson, who had fallen forward. Wallum and Moore were the first soldiers out the door, raising their rifles and firing as they went. Sandusky hung back. He'd gotten a look at the Vietnamese force out there. At least 24. And that was his guess without counting or getting a real good look. And that meant there were more. There were always ones that you couldn't see. This was his second tour, and he intended to get out of it alive. As the rest of the men raced out, all of them firing, some of them dying as bullets slammed into them, Sandusky edged deeper into the building. There was a large Buddha at the back, decorated in gold and silver, and just big enough to squat behind. He hid just as the firing stopped. Outside, men talked in a language Sandusky didn't understand. Slopeheads. And that meant Thompson, Moore, Wallum, and all the others were dead. The Viet Cong talked among themselves, pacing and moving things around, and finally leaving. Sandusky's legs cramped from the position, but he didn't dare move. He didn't move for what he guessed was a few hours. When it had gotten so dark that he couldn't see anything, he stood, rubbing at his numb legs to get the feeling back. He stumbled forward and into one statue after another. He could hardly walk. His legs weren't cooperating. At last, he found the opening and cautiously looked out. It had stopped raining, and there were just enough stars overhead so that he could see the bodies of his fellows. Not a single VC corpse. They'd either taken their fallen, or Thompson and the others hadn't scored a single hit. Sandusky went from one body to the next, discovering that the VC had taken the treasure. However, they missed a diamond ring that Thompson had taken. The gem was the size of a big sunflower seed. Sandusky plucked it loose, and then went to collect the dog tags. But there weren't any.
Damn slopeheads took them.
Sandusky hadn't seen Lan Vuong carefully pluck each tag loose and put a bullet in the head of each soldier, just to be sure they were dead. He hadn't seen the colonel collect blood from each man and say a twisted prayer to Papa Gede. Sandusky returned to the building, where he hid until dawn. Then he picked up enough small pieces of treasure to fill his pockets and pack, and headed down the trail to the east.
War is always the same. It is young men done in the fullness of their promise. I promise it won't get me.
Thank you. Rogue Angel 28, Restless Soul, is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited. Used by others under license. Copyright 2011, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Keegan, Tony Nam, Terrence Aselford, Joe Brack, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, Christopher Sheeran, MJ Casey, Richard Rowan, Jeff Allen, Danny Gavigan, Ken Jackson, Scott McCormick, Mort Shelby, Alyssa Wilmoth, Dolores King-Williams, and David Coyne. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Allison Thomas. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krenzlin. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Lilith St. Crow's Dante Valentine series and Elizabeth Moon's Vada's War series. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now in graphic audio.
Don't do this, Birdman. Don't. Don't!
The spirits told me to do this. Are you ready? Ready for the unity of our power?
Let her up.
I will have to kill you someday, Windrunner. Whatever I have to do, I will have White Ash.
Listen, you're destined for greatness. Go north, find the dreamer. Promise! Promise!
I promise.
Windrunner?
I'm leaving tomorrow.
Leaving?
I can go to the Black Point, earn a place among them, and when I do, I can ask you to marry me.
That's crazy!
Do you love me?
Yes.
I'll be back for you.
Bad Belly. Man of the people.
Who are you?
I am First Man, the Wolf Dreamer.
Go away! Leave me alone! I've done nothing!
The Sun People come. The spiral is changing. Are you willing to fulfill a promise to power?
No, this can't be. There are too many. What are you gonna do with me?
What does any man want with a woman?
No!
I only came back to steal White Ash away. Now I have to find her.
Be careful.
I know. Is White Ash with Windrunner?
No. Wolf people.
If I have to destroy every man, woman, and child among the wolf people, I'll have her.
North America's Forgotten Past. Book 3. People of the Earth. In graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.